Instead of the formal refuge, I would love to sing the mantra of Mani Padme Hum with you. And I give you a few words more of explanation before we start. I already said that it is the mantra of the four immeasurable qualities. And we could go into the detail how the syllables arise from these qualities. But the more obvious meaning is that Mani means jewel and Padma means lotus and Padme means with a lotus. And it describes the Buddha of enlightened compassion, Chenrezig or Avalokiteshvara. And whenever I think of this Mani, this jewel, then I remember the moment when our teacher explained to us, you know, Avalokiteshvara, when you look on the tanka, on the picture, then he's holding this jewel just in front of the heart, you know, a jewel, and which is a wish-fulfilling jewel. So wish-fulfilling jewel means whatever wishes you address to this jewel, they come true. Now, what is this jewel? Actually, it's the jewel of our own mind. Yeah, so this is actually, we are singing the mantra of devotion, of compassion, of, you know, all these qualities, knowing that we have Buddhahood in our hands, because we are ourselves, of course, also. Chenrezig Avalokiteshvara. It's not just in front or and somewhere else, but we are also all beings. We are that. And then the name continues with Padma, the one with the lotus. So there is a lotus unfolding next to his left ear with a stem around the elbow. And this is the lotus of the fully unfolded qualities of awakening, huh? The bodhicitta qualities. So all the qualities of bodhicitta are there. And then what is not in the mantra, because that's not necessary, it's just the one, it's called the one with the jewel and the lotus, right? That's sufficient. But then in his right hand, he has, because he has four hands, you know, two to hold the jewel, one for the lotus, and one for the mala. So, yeah, I have my mala with me. So, he is often depicted like this, that he is sitting there with two hands in front of the heart and the other two hands open like this. And the right hand is turning a mala. And mala means this rosary. And every turn of the mala in our recitation would be one mantra. But for Avalokiteshvara, every turn of the mala signifies inspiring sentient beings to leave samsara. You know? Like pulling them out of samsara, but as you know, he can't because he needs a tara to help him. So, but together, it's this activity of inspiring beings to come out of samsara, to leave the world of clinging behind, and to enter the four immeasurables. Yeah, that's the symbol of this rosary in the right hand. It's the activity. The bodhicitta here is, you can say, it's the motivation. It is, but it's more than a motivation because the Buddha doesn't have a motivation anymore. It is just sitting in the fullness of these qualities and holding the jewel in front of our hearts signifies that we are in the complete confidence that all the happiness that we could ever seek for is already in our hands, that we don't have to look anywhere else. It's right there. Actually, we are holding our heart. It's only a symbol to show that we are holding our Buddha heart. So in some descriptions, the jewel is even left away because it's a prayer mudra in front of the heart, and no need to mention the jewel because the heart is the jewel. Yeah? It's like the heart mind is the jewel. Okay, with that little bit more understanding, then I invite you to chant along with me. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Padma Hum, Om Mani Padma Hum, Om Mani Padma Hum, thank you so much for singing along. Of course, we could go into much more detail. You know, in the past, I was giving every year a 1 week course on Shenrezig, on Avalokiteshvara only that practice, year after year, always going deeper. You know, like there is so much. It's a complete practice. But what is interesting for us is that the lineage of the Mahamudra masters, to which I am connected, is identical to the lineage of the masters who have realized Avalokiteshvara. To have realized Avalokiteshvara means that you have gone so far that you experience no more separation, and that Avalokiteshvara appears in a vision to you, or in several visions, that it becomes so, the connection becomes so strong that the Buddha speaks to you in person. And this kind of vision is like this, that even, you know, often it is so strong that the practitioner faints because it's so overwhelming. But when you come back from having been unconscious, the vision is still there. That's the kind of vision we are talking about, you know. Even if you turn around, you want to get away. You can't get away. You know, it's very strong, and it's deeply, like, this is how the instructions were passed on. And it's the same instructions as the instructions on Mahamudra. It's only that the way to practice the mantra is a means to put Mahamudra into practice. And there is, for example, one famous Mahamudra teaching which I gave, which is actually a teaching on Avalokiteshvara by the famous master Karma Chakme. It's called The Unity of Mahamudra and Dzogchen. It is Avalokiteshvara singing the teaching on the unity of Mahamudra and Dzogchen. Yes? Dzogchen is another very famous Tibetan lineage of meditating directly on the nature of mind. And I know some here in the group, they have told me they have just been with a Dzogchen teacher, and it's like Mahamudra, like the preliminaries are the same, everything I've explained so far, I see no difference. So far, everything is identical. Yeah, so just for those who have been exposed to another transmission with a little bit different name, this dog Chen, when you translate, you can translate this as Chen, great dog, perfection, the great perfection. And Mahamudra is the great seer, but actually they share the same teachings. They have slightly different lineages, and the methods are a little bit different in some areas. But for example, using Avalokiteshvara as the main yidam, as the main deity practice, is same in both lineages. And they cross over, and I have received both lineages, and my teacher had received both lineages and mastered both lineages. So actually, sometimes we practice a little bit, you know, we explain a little bit more with the words like this, more with the words like that. This morning, I was, for example, teaching you about this pristine purity, this inherent primordial purity of the mind, which is always there. Remember, there was a little passage there about that inherent purity. And that is a typical Dzogchen teaching. The term is Kadak in Tibetan, and it means this purity which has no beginning. Yes, this is a way of explaining things that has entered the Mahamudra lineage from the Mahaati or Dzogchen lineage. Yes, just to give those who are a little bit more studied to give an example of this, and to put those at ease who just come out of a Dzogchen retreat and they have loved it so much, and they should really continue with that, because that's perfect. Yeah, it's a wonderful approach to practice and a wonderful understanding of reality. Okay, now let's change subject, go a little bit further. I want to pick up one point of the question and answer session yesterday. I was asked why we do this cleansing practice with the nine breathing and the three retentions, and I answered in order to enhance clarity and luminosity and to dispel sloth and torpor. My answer was necessarily short, and I want to explain you a little bit more what's the point of clarity, luminosity. Now, you see, obviously, when we are about to fall asleep and, you know, our mind becomes dull, everyone notices. We notice ourselves outside, even you can also notice. Yeah? So then this is also very good exercise to drive away that form of sloth and torpor. This is called the coarse or rough, gross level form of dullness. But that is a subtle dullness. A subtle dullness, a subtle sluggishness of mind, which often meditators don't notice. And I speak from experience, because seemingly I've been in that for several months in my first year of retreat. Yes? So the subtle level of dullness and torpor is you sit clearly, straight, you don't feel tired. You know, maybe eyes open, maybe eyes closed. You feel like you're really in a state of samadhi. But somehow, your presence becomes a little vague, a little hazy. Yeah, not quite on the point, not really aware, not fully there. And one can spend hours in that because it's so pleasant. Yeah, it's extremely nice. And it is gratifying to have such a peace. And I still remember how I was sitting with Gendo Rinpoche. Now, I had been in retreat for 7 months, and it was he called us into his room, and then he looked at me and he said to me, "You are practicing sheep shine, sheep shamatha." You know, my and I was in very lucid states of mind, but my shamatha was like a sheep. That's the, you know, like sometimes they call it dark shamatha also, because it is not that pristine clarity and luminosity, but a comfortable clarity. It's comfortable. You know, it's like, ah, so nice to be. And then you stop. You're so nice to be, and you install yourself in the niceness of the experience. Yeah? It's so nice. And it's so, and the body doesn't feel pain. It can continue for hours, and it feels almost as if you had no kleshas anymore. You know, it feels so, so nice. And we call that fine torpor, fine sluggishness of mind. Yeah, so this is the subtle form. And to do this exercise actually is especially also for the subtle form of, yeah, to enhance a greater clarity and then to sit in that clarity, full clarity, and not to try to make it last. Because the other form comes from wanting to make it last. It comes from a slight clinging to calm, a calm mind, peaceful mind, a slight clinging to that, wanting to stabilize that. And in order to stabilize that, one blocks some of the sensitivity or the receptivity of the mind, the clarity, and then one is not in a sleepy state, but one is in a protective samadhi bubble. Yeah? I hope this is maybe for those of you who have been meditating a lot, and I see some of you nodding. So it seems, yes, exactly, you know what I'm talking about. And then the practitioner is asked to be a little bit radical and to say, stop now, you know? I don't want to pass my months and years in that kind of state. I'm going for a greater clarity and a greater, you know, I stop with this clinging to the calm and peace. I do a little exercise. Yeah. And then for a short time, oh, yeah. And one feels the difference. One feels, wow. Whew. The body feels different. The mind feels different. Oh, yeah. And this is what I meant yesterday when I talked to you about tensing, you know, tensing and relaxing, you know, energizing the practice and relaxing. And, you know, so this would be the first point with the vitalizing our practice and going into that clarity, that quick clarity that is, you can say, top clarity of mind, you know, just the full clarity. Not a reduced one. It's like, you know, of course, we all like to meditate a little bit in shady places, and we wouldn't want to switch the light on here. But this reduced clarity is like we have our luminosity, our natural luminosity, but we always turn the dimmer down a little bit. Yeah, it's like dimming our own clarity, because then with dim clarity, we can last longer. We are on an easy ride. Yeah. But actually we are not fully present, and we lose time because we are in a subtle way, we are blocking processes and we don't notice it. Yeah. So it's very normal, because also for me, this was a time when I was exploring samadhi, samatha states and so on, but the progress was always coming for moments of greater clarity or deeper relaxation. And now I come to the second point. Huh? The second point is about the relaxation. And I said for the relaxation yesterday that it is to relax the agitation. Now, everyone knows when we have an agitated mind, lots of thoughts. It feels like a storm or a waterfall, or, you know, it's like lots is going on. And then we need to relax. And this relaxation, now I think I've already explained it, but it is not relaxing out of the storm, like trying to get into some protected place. It is opening up in a relaxed way to a non-clinging and non-fighting mind. No aversion, no attachment. Yeah, it's this, again, we open up into a luminosity, but this luminosity doesn't have the feeling of a heightened luminosity, but an accepting luminosity of very spacious mind. So what we call relaxing is actually opening up into a spacious presence in which the activity of the mind can gradually calm down. Because that activity is karmic. I mean, it's due to all the impulses, all the input that we had, all the past experiences. And so, and some people have a more active mind. I mean, they are more on the vata pitta spectrum than the others who are more on the kapha, you know, the earth element is stronger. So there's differences. So, but this is important to understand. We don't just calm the mind by kind of again dimming the mind. No. We open, you know, actually an agitated mind is like a closed mind in which things go havoc because there's not enough space and there's too much clinging. So what we do, we relax the clinging and we open the mind as if we were to open the windows, become one with space, become very clear and not involved. Okay, that's for the gross level agitation. Now we have subtle level agitation. Okay, subtle level agitation is actually, it can be very subtle. Actually, subtle level agitation is subtle fears active in us of which we are normally not even aware. So subtle level agitation, we can connect to the activity of these undercurrents, sometimes also translated as outflows, for example, the wish to exist is connected to the fear not to exist. The wish not to exist is connected to the fear to exist. The wish to have sense impressions is again connected to the feeling having sense impressions, including having thoughts, producing thinking, confirms that I am. So it feels like confirmation of my being that I have sense impressions. So this is a subtle restlessness, which every meditator will encounter. And this is beautiful that we encounter this, because for normal people, it is completely unconscious. And even now I sit here, you know, I'm talking to you, and who am I to know whether I'm not talking to you because of a wish for self-confirmation, you know? Or yes, so maybe you are not so much aware with these undercurrents or outflows. Shall I explain them quickly or lengthy? Yes, the three or four outflows. Yes, I can explain them. Okay. I think the proper Tibetan and Pali, the Sanskrit and Pali term is asavas, huh? And these. What the Buddha talked about is something that we would say is unconscious or subconscious from the point of view of the normal person. There is an agitation in the ground of our being which becomes conscious. So it's better to say it's pre-conscious because it can become conscious. And every meditator, as we relax, as we open up, then comes to barriers in the relaxation. We cannot relax deeper. There's definitely no. I don't want to relax deeper because then I lose control. Yeah, you know, it's like What happens then? There is a fear coming there. And this, that what is actually the yeah, I can explain it like this. You know how carpets are woven? Carpets, beautiful patterns and so on. The wool makes beautiful patterns, but that is a fabric which holds the wool. Yes? This underlying fabric of samsara, these are these undercurrents. And there are two, three different lists of what these basic undercurrents or outflows are. Outflow means our energy flows out because the attention goes to something that is not helpful. So it's like also the idea is one of losing attention. And then the other meaning of the word is an undercurrent, something that is like in an ocean, the undercurrent which stimulates then the smaller currents and the waves on top. Yeah, it's in this sense also. So the first one, which is the most current and most usual, is the wish to exist due to the fear not to exist. And to relax, there comes the point where we encounter an experience where we become shaky. We don't know if less control will mean non-existence or becoming crazy or, you know, what's going to happen. And maybe you remember times in your meditation when you were relaxing like this. Relax, open, everything is, suddenly there is a jerk in your energy system. Suddenly, like a catapult, you know? And this is when you have touched that point. You have touched the point where automatically self-protection, you know, takes you out of relaxing more, danger zone. So when you continue practicing, you begin to become familiar. Remember, bhavana means to become familiar, the word for meditation. You become familiar with this area where not so sure about existence, you know, but life is continuing. So you open up, and definitely in order to make a stable experience of absence of self needs a deep trust to enter that just being without the need for control. So that would be a description of how to deal with the first outflow or undercurrent, yeah, the wish to exist. Then when existence is very painful, when dukkha dominates, there's also the wish not to exist. Okay? The wish not to exist is to get out of here. And it is like the attachment, the wish to exist. It is an aversion towards existence, and it's the wish not to exist because existence is so painful, and there is fear of more dukkha, fear of more painful experiences. So that underlying current can also create the same kind of restlessness. Yeah? It's like because meditation in this opening actually makes us encounter an aliveness. And it's not for everybody the same that to feel so alive is immediately pleasant, because there is a secret wish actually not to be alive. Yeah, so that could be for some people here in the room, that could have been an issue. Yeah, that starting to meditate, then you thought that maybe meditation would make you safe. And like finding a little niche in the world where you can almost not exist. And then happens what needs to happen. Because of the opening, you feel so much indescribable aliveness. So many, yeah, so much is coming up. And that also creates shock waves, you know, like wanting, oh, no, this is too sensitive. This is too much alive. I don't want to feel all of that. So these two basic tendencies, they are connected to two other basic tendencies. The wish to exist is connected to the wish to have sense impressions. Yeah, to feel, to have sensory contact. And of course, when we begin to sit calmly, we are in a way experiencing sensory deprivation. Okay, we are not in a very stimulating context. And many people experience boredom as a passing through phenomenon. Yeah, we get bored because there's not enough sensory stimulation. But in the depths of our being, the wish for sensory contact actually then expresses itself in the wish to think, because that's sensory. Yeah, I exist because I think. Yes, it's like, oh, you know this sentence from somewhere. And it's so true. This is self-confirmation. Yeah, it's because I see, because you see me, because we talk, because I can touch, because I can feel my body. As long as all of that happens, I can be sure that I exist. But then going into greater states of openness, there is less sensory input, especially if I stop engaging with conceptual activity. And that stimulus, you know, that's the restlessness of the conceptual activity and the sensory activity, always having to look around, always our attention with the ears going to what's happening around, always being busy with one's body. You know, all of that is the expression of that basic tendency. And then the wish for non-existence or for not feeling how lively one is connected to the wish of not wanting to be aware, is the wish for ignorance. So that's a secondary, you can say, secondary outflow or undercurrent, that actually, because our liveliness and our sensitivity and the mind are too much, we want to, you know, be like the monkey, yeah? How to do like this. And please, a third hand on the heart, you know, nothing comes, yeah? So we don't want to feel, we don't want to, and this is a basic impulse for ignorance, for not being aware. And we are not conscious of that, but this is a very strong self-protecting attitude, which is highly refined. And some people are so highly refined in that the moment they sit in a Dharma talk, they become drowsy. But they're close to falling asleep because that's stimulating too much. It's like, wow. And then as soon as the pause comes, no trace of drowsiness. Even if they were to lie down in bed, they can't sleep, you know? So this is one of them. But have you ever noticed that when your partner wanted to tell you something, you suddenly couldn't hear anymore? You know, you suddenly didn't understand half the sentence, or you were gone for two sentences. And, you know, but it's the same thing. And this is an undercurrent that can become conscious. So we correct that. Yes, and then sometimes, you know, depending on which Abhidharma you follow, that is an undercurrent of clinging to views, wanting to cling to opinions and the ways of seeing, you know, which is also self-protection. It's reference points, actually, clinging to views is clinging to reference points, holding on to something. Yeah, it's like, it's so much more sure that nothing can happen to me for as long as I hold on to this. If I let go of that, then I don't know anymore. Yeah. So whatever the list is, it doesn't matter. Look for those underlying tendencies. Yeah. The wishes, the underlying wishes and the underlying fears. And that's where practice needs to take us. Yeah, it needs to take us into those deeper areas. And now I come back to the point, you know, relaxing subtle agitation is about how to bring in a fearless, spacious attitude in those agitating undercurrents. Yes? So That's a great art, and it needs so much development of trust and blessing and devotion and love, and not doing it for myself, because if it were for myself, I would get out of here. Yeah, it's like, but for the non-self, for the openness, you know, then, yeah, let's. Okay, and also maybe I see that how much suffering is in that restlessness, which is created by this undercurrent. I can feel the dukkha, because all these dualistic tendencies, they come from that. Yes, and I can feel how much the torpor, yeah, the subtle dullness, how much that is a protection. So I begin to feel the dukkha in both aspects, and actually, finally, I begin to understand that torpor is restlessness. They're not different. It's just outer manifestation which is different. Inwardly, torpor is an activity of the mind. It's a protective activity. So I don't need to explain separately. Yeah, it's a protection shield. So this is what we are faced with in deep practice, and in both times the answer of Mahamudra, or I guess of every meditation tradition, is to enhance the open, spacious presence. If needed, a little bit heightened presence, a little bit more energetic, or if needed, a little bit more relaxed open spaciousness. But these are slight variations in what you would always call complete luminosity. It's not that one is less luminous than the other, it's just that how we find into it is a little different. Sometimes by straightening up, sometimes by relaxing into it. Okay? Both ways are fine. And actually, I don't look into my mind what is needed now. Somehow my mind knows what is needed. Yes, no need to look into a manual and to see, is this torpor now, or is this restlessness? Actually, by saying yes to luminosity, I will find the way. My mind will find the way. If I say yes to open, dynamic presence without blockages, if I say yes to that, this mind will find the way. It does. It knows the way, because it's the most relaxed state of being. And our mind has this incredible capacity or innate tendency to, if we allow it to go to the most relaxed state, the mind finds its way out of dukkha if we allow it to happen. It's incredible. It only depends on how much relaxation we can take before we go into grasping again. But if we allow, if we don't mix with manipulation and grasping and so on, if we allow, then the mind behaves like the gas in a compressed bottle. You know, when you buy gas, you know, it's like compressed in a bottle. So that's why they, you have these heavy steel bottles. Huh? And you always have to, when you open them, like, yeah, it comes out with so much pressure. Actually, we are like samsaric bottles. Okay? And we think we are very different inside from the outside. Very different. And meditation is, and the gas, which is our mind, just opens up like by the activity of the molecules of gas. You know, you have this, I forgot the chemical term, but there is a, I will come back to mine, but there is this molecular activity which spreads the molecules of the gas to the widest possible distribution. Huh? Diffusion, yes. The Brownian molecular activity. And this is what Brown described so nicely for the molecules. This is actually what is happening with the mind if you allow it. It goes into the most relaxed state. Like actually everything in nature. If the forces that bring it into 10 states, if they are not there anymore, then everything goes into the most relaxed state. And that's same for our mind. It's part of the nature of mind. So Mahamudra view, if we have a view, would be that the tendency for awakening is inherent in the nature of mind. Because of this, yeah, because that's what happens when everything that is artificial stops, then mind opens, becomes vast, becomes luminous, spacious, and doesn't lose its clarity. Okay? The clarity is there. We come back to that issue later. Now it's time to meditate a little. Yes, I hope you still have the courage to meditate. So, please don't use the dimmer. Yeah, go for the clarity. A clarity that is very relaxed, not like fixed. It's not a fixed clarity, it's a relaxed clarity. Very fluid. We continue quarter to five. This gives you 20 minutes in silence. Those who like and continue. Let's meditate a little bit more. I mean, it's already happening, so you don't have to do something extra. Now, even if your meditation is really wide and clear, I invite you to come back to breathing with the four immeasurables. This grounds our meditation. It connects us with our body. It connects so-called heart qualities of love and compassion. The open space of samadhi is always there. Samadhi, stable meditation, is to remain undistractedly in that which is wholesome. Spacious awareness becomes less spacious, you can say, less spaced out when it connects to the breathing. But it nevertheless remains as limitless as before. Boundless, limitless presence. While being very finely aware, for example, of breathing in and breathing out with a gentle, soft awareness. A gentle, soft touch, you can say, a flavor. Finally aware, seeing the ungraspable nature, having the taste of the empty nature, continuous without blockages. no clinging to these words, just the warm, open breathing. I would like to share another aspect of practice with you. I was asked in the staff meeting, mainly those people who are working in the kitchen, what was my personal practice? And then I began talking about meditation. And in the end, I had to correct myself. I said, no, I forgot to tell you about something, you know, because actually I spend a lot of time contemplating the daily problems in my formal meditation in the morning. I have 3 hours, so I also take a lot of time to let all the issues of the day come up. And now as I was sitting, I remember when we asked Gendo Rinpoche, you know, highly realized master, how he was meditating on what he was meditating on. And he answered, I'm meditating your problems. That was his answer. And incredible, yeah, because then his mind was not preoccupied with anything personal. So he just lets it dwell in the issues, you know, in this big sangha and what the various practitioners are going through. Of course, it was helped a lot by his clairvoyant powers. So that was an interesting answer, and it took me a while to understand. But another teaching helped me, because you know, the teaching on the three wisdoms due to the three practices of listening, studying, contemplating, and meditating. Yeah, so you probably have heard of these three. Yeah, that, and they give rise to an understanding due to deep study and listening to teachings. They give rise to this wisdom, the understanding due to putting all of this into a connection with our own personal experience. This is what we tend to call contemplation. And this contemplation is using the intellect, is using the conceptual mind. And then there is the non-conceptual meditation, which goes beyond all analytical processes or reasoning or conceptual processes. That's the meaning of meditation. So in many meditation circles, yes, there is a certain amount of teaching, which involves then listening, hearing, and also studying the teachings. And then one focuses on meditation. So there's a lot of meditation being done. And at least in the circles that I know, for many years, there was a lack of contemplation. Contemplation is actually the practice where we bring that what we have heard and understood in direct contact and direct relationship with our personal experience. So, simple example, we have heard teaching on impermanence, change, you know, the and so on. Yeah, let's just take that simple one. That might, we might die soon and we might live long, who knows, but no one is sure. Yeah, and then general teaching, what does that mean for me? If this is about me, what does it mean to be aware of the possibility not to live so long as I thought, maybe? So immediately, like for me, the consequence of this contemplation is a change of attitude, right? There's an important change of attitude. It leads to an attitude of doing first things first and never to leave home in a dispute, you know, but to clear things before you leave so that even if you die, things are clear. Yes, like this. And to know when I, for example, when I sit in the car or I take a plane, you know, then to know maybe I don't return. You know, maybe this is my last WhatsApp to my partner. You know, maybe. Yes, to always have that there, it sharpens. It sharpens my way of dealing with situations. And all of that is contemplation. Yeah, it is not the thinking of understanding what the teaching said. You know, to be able to properly reproduce that is the art of listening deeply, being able to give the full meaning of what was explained. That is the first necessary act of developing Dharma understanding. But the next step of understanding comes from applying it to myself and to see how it transforms me. Because every Dharma teaching is medicine. Every single one. So like I gave you the teaching about refuge. Huh? Now you can listen to the teaching and properly understand it. But what does it mean if I apply the going for refuge, if I apply it to my life? How about if my activity becomes a constant going for refuge? How is that? Does it help? Does it not help? To find out and to reflect upon this deeply, this is the act of contemplation. And contemplation has a taste that it is not a reflection which is like rattling on, you know, it's not like continuous cycles of thinking, but reflection has a special taste of taking it in, pausing, getting a taste, having another thought about it, feeling how that, you know, how that is. So there are a lot of pauses in the reflection. Pauses which are filled with feeling, with a very intimate contact. And we can feel that our understanding due to listening and studying, that it begins to work. And we have creative doubts about it. We have questions that arise and we have aha, are like this. Okay. And there are understandings. And usually what happens in deeper contemplations, especially like when I contemplate about the issues of the day, you know, of what is waiting for me in the day, or what has been yesterday, and so on, then it's not the moment to meditate when I say, don't reflect about the past, don't project into the future. You know, that doesn't apply. That's not the moment, huh? That would be the wrong moment for this kind of instruction. Now I do think about the past. I learn from the past. I apply the Dharma to my past experiences from yesterday. I think how I could do it better. I reflect. Oh, if I had been a little bit more relaxed, not so defensive, how would that have been? And then I breathe through, you know, I have the situation. I continue with breathing, with the four immeasurables, yeah, and I have the situation present. I'm still contemplating. I'm not in a non-conceptual meditation. Actually, I'm working through the issues of the day, of the week, of life, you know, and this is such an important aspect of practice. So in many Dharma circles in Europe, we are now enhancing contemplative practices. Because somehow, if we only listen and study and then meditate, there seems to be a gap of integration with our daily life. So, since I have so much time, then I can take, first I do the non-conceptual practice of not reflecting upon and so on, and then I feel, okay, now my mind has really relaxed. It has opened. That's my touchdown. Okay, good. Wonderful. Now I'm ready to face life, to enter life. I'm the CEO of a company, a non-profit company. I have, you know, different employees. I have financial issues to deal with, and there's always little conflicts somewhere, you know, little unsolved questions and so on. Yes, so all of that needs my attention, and this has become the second part of my practice, and that's contemplation. So the issues, I bring them in together with my Dharma understanding. I kind of breathe through them. I ventilate them. This is like a good way to say I bring in the energy of loving awareness and all my Dharma understanding. I begin to shift viewpoints, take the viewpoints of different people concerned by the issue, you know, how it is for this one, for that one, for her, for him, for me, for the whole community, how it will be in the long-term future, how in the short-term future, you know. All of this happens very spontaneously, but it is an inner work. It is an inner work, and it has the effect that when I find the solution, when actually I don't find the solution, but because of this going around, breathing through, like not being fixed in one view, like then at some point, a clarity installs itself. And when that clarity comes, I know, that's it. No need to go further. There is a physical feeling of just that, you know? That's it. For the moment, it's that. And for that issue, then I can go into the day and I will live that clarity. And all of this was a contemplative process, but when the clarity arises, usually there is a meditation which follows. Because there's a natural opening of mind. The mind is relieved of the tension of uncertainty, not knowing how to handle the situation, all of that, you know, maybe also relieved of an anger, an anxiety or something like that. And then again, there is a phase of just being open. That would be a meditation. That's non-concept. And since it is so open, also the next issue can show, if you have time. But at least I wish for all of you have time for one issue per day. That would be good. Yeah, very good, because like this, integration will happen. Your Dharma understanding due to listening and studying and due to meditation and developing practices like metta meditation, tonglen, and so on, all of that will integrate with what's actually going on in your life. And it needs our full attention. It's not just in passing by that we will do the best job. It's good to really give it time. And actually, I have to admit, when I meditate in the evening at night, I mostly digest the day. Mostly, I just sit, open awareness, letting things flow through. I wouldn't call it such a constructive contemplation as in the morning when I'm fresh, but I'm basically digesting the day. And then when I feel that digestion is good, is enough, then perhaps I'm still clear enough to do some meditation, yeah, to go into that lucidity of the clear mind and just to sit. And again, that's then the moment not to reflect on the past, not to project oneself into the future, no comments on the present, no analysis, no meditation. Just be natural. You know, the six dharmas of Tilopa. Then, that's the right moment. Okay. But sometimes I'm too tired. When it's the evening, then I fall asleep. Okay? So, also there, no fixed program, but don't force meditation on you when you have so much to digest. That would be artificial. Yeah, if you force yourself into something like non-thinking, or you have really something to digest, then the practice is contemplation. Yeah? And this contemplation can alternate with meditation. Short passages, like you can say, okay, before any further reflection here, contemplation, first 10 minutes of just anapana, you know, may all of that just drop away. And then, you know, you let it drop away, and maybe it continues longer because that feels really good and helpful. But after that decided period, you look if that issue that was bothering you is still an issue that you want to turn your attention to. Yeah, and then you do it. Yeah. That's how Dharma practice integrates with everyday life. And you would do that with every emotional issue, every family issue, every political issue that is on your mind, you know, everything. You would just do it. Because it's anyhow on your mind. And if in that contemplation you see that you're turning in circles, that the same thought comes again, then it's not useful anymore. Then you stop. You know, then it's not creative anymore. You're not going deeper in the understanding. You're turning in circles. Then it's time to meditate and say, okay, I don't seem to be able to come to a conclusion. That's okay. It can be like that. Let me sit without any searching. And then you drop out of the reflection. Okay? You drop out of the contemplation. Doesn't make sense to turn in circles. Okay? That was a longer answer now to that question. And now we will do exactly that. We will contemplate together because now it's time for the questions and answers. It's 5:15. And if you need to quickly go to the toilet, do it. But I will already take the first questions. And of course, all those who don't wish to have the conceptual mind stimulated, this is the time to leave the hall. Okay? Because this will be conceptual now. Yes. So I give the little moment for you to leave the hall.